introduce mandatory digital ID for all British citizens by 2029. The announcement sparked fury across the full spectrum of the British political landscape, uniting forces who would otherwise disagree on pretty much everything else. The digital ID's plans have led to continuous protests, with thousands braving wintry weather conditions in London on Saturday to express their opposition to the plans.
We're here to protest digital ID. We're also here to make the point to people that they're already being tracked, they're already being surveilled and controlled by systems beyond their knowledge or control. And this is just an extra step. And this is almost a way for the government to act like we're giving our consent for them to track us. But they're doing it anyway.
The main justification given by Starmer for the rollout of digital IDs is to help the government's crackdown on illegal migration, leading to suspicions that the so-called migrant crisis was allowed to develop to then justify these types of draconian measures in response.
A massive fear that many Brits have is that the digital ID plans, in combination with a rumoured ban on the use of cash in the future, portends the creation of a dystopian AI-powered control grid where every move you make is subject to surveillance and censorship by the state in real time.
These protesters believe that enough of the country is opposed to the digital ID rollout, but that for mass non-compliance to become a realistic prospect, unity across the political spectrum is a must.
Anybody organising anything can be controlled by this. So we want everyone to unite in common cause. As you say in our leaflet here, Palestine and freedom fighters, indeed everyone, unite in common cause.
The British state has long wanted to introduce digital IDs, going as far back as when Tony Blair floated the prospect when he was Prime Minister in the 2000s. But with mass opposition already forming and one of the most unpopular governments in recent history at the helm, opponents are quietly confident in their chances of defeating the entire idea altogether. Issa Kadhimi, London.
Ukraine's European allies are holding talks on the sideline of the G20 summit over Trump's proposed peace plan to end the Ukraine war. In a joint statement, they described the proposal as unilateral, saying that it requires additional work. They expressed concern over the proposed limitations on Ukraine's armed forces, saying it leaves the country vulnerable to future attacks.
The war can only end with Ukraine's unconditional consent. Wars cannot be ended by major powers over the heads of the countries involved. Rather, this is a war that can only end with Ukraine's consent and with our consent, the consent of the European Union, because it is a war on the European continent.
Kiev has also rejected key elements of the plan. The Ukrainian president's office said the country will never be an obstacle to peace, but emphasized that its representatives would continue to defend the legitimate interests of the Ukrainian people. President Volodymyr Zelensky has warned that Ukraine is facing one of the most difficult moments in its history.
Now is one of the most difficult moments in our history. Now the pressure on Ukraine is one of the most difficult. Now Ukraine may find itself facing a very difficult choice. Either the loss of dignity, or the risk of losing a key partner. We did not betray Ukraine then, we will not do it now. And I know for sure that in this truly one of the most difficult moments in our history, I am not alone.
Neighboring Poland also expressed firm opposition, insisting that any peace agreement must be accepted by Kiev and that Ukrainians themselves must have a central role in negotiations. The White House has denied that Ukraine was sidelined, but skepticism in Europe remains high. Trump, meanwhile, has escalated pressure on Kiev, warning that Ukraine would lose additional territory in a short amount of time if it refused the plan, and declaring that Zelensky is going to have to approve it.
Well, he'll have to like it, and if he doesn't like it, then, you know, they should just keep fighting, I guess, you know.
The U.S. president said he had given Ukraine until Thursday to agree to the plan. According to widely leaked drafts, the U.S. plan includes several concessions Ukraine has previously ruled out. These include recognizing Crimea, Luhansk, and Donetsk as de facto Russian, obliging Ukraine to constitutionally renounce NATO membership, and reducing Ukraine's armed forces to 600,000 troops. Additional provisions would bar NATO troop deployments in Ukraine. The text also outlines steps for Russia's reintegration into the global economy and its return to the G8. For many European governments, the episode has exposed a far deeper worry. A peace plan drafted behind closed doors, unveiled as a near final document, and built around sweeping concessions to Moscow, has intensified the sense that Washington under Trump is no longer behaving like a dependable ally. European officials say the administration bypassed NATO entirely, kept key European capitals in the dark about provisions that directly affect their own security, and excluded Ukraine, the country at the center of the war, from any meaningful role in shaping its terms. For Europe, the episode is a blunt reminder that under Trump, the United States is prepared to act unilaterally on matters central to Europe's security, even if its closest allies are left entirely out of the room.
Yemen's health minister Ali Shayban paints a stark picture of a health system suffocating under siege. Medicines are vanishing, chronic patients are deteriorating, children are dying before help can reach them. He called the shutdown of Sana'a International Airport a crime against humanity, especially after Israeli strikes destroyed its capacity, cutting off the only viable route for life-saving drugs. Families now face a brutal reality. No airport means no treatment, and no treatment means lives lost.
Today, we renew our call for the United Nations to operate flights and reopen Sana'a International Airport to save thousands of patients who urgently need to travel abroad for treatment. More than 250,000 patients require medical travel for serious and life-threatening conditions. Over 1,330 types of essential medicines, including immune therapies and other critical drugs, have not been allowed into the country due to the air blockade.
The ministry says thousands have been deprived of essential medications due to the air blockade. It warns that inaction would cause more deaths that can be simply prevented.
The continued closure of Sana'a International Airport clearly proves that the international humanitarian and health organizations that constantly preach about human rights are fully politicized and operate under American and Israeli influence. The clearest example is what is happening in Yemen, where thousands of people urgently need to travel for treatment but remain unable to do so as the airport remains closed to this moment.
Israel struck Sana'a International Airport in early May this year, damaging its runway, terminal, and several aircraft. The regime struck the facility again as Yemen continued its military operations against Israeli targets in response to its war on Gaza. Yemen's health ministry says the reopening of the airport, once a lifeline for the population, is an urgent humanitarian obligation, not a political convenience.
The health crisis continues to escalate as life-saving medicines remain blocked from entering the country. Officials warn that unless urgent steps are taken to restore medical access, thousands of vulnerable patients will face worsening conditions with no alternative options. Abdul Latif Loshali, Sana'a.
The latest U.S. jobs reports paints a bleak portrait of the American economy under President Donald Trump. Newly released data showed the unemployment rate climbed to 4.4% in September, its highest level since October 2021, signaling a labor market losing momentum. Industries once considered pillars of the American economy are faltering. Transportation and warehousing shed more than 25,000 jobs, while manufacturing lost another 6,000 positions. The report itself was delayed for weeks due to the government shutdown, a disruption triggered by political brinkmanship in Washington. Its release now lands alongside troubling inflation data. Manual inflation in September reached its highest reading since January, confirming that prices are accelerating at their fastest pace of the year. Economists point to one major culprit behind rising costs: Trump's aggressive and increasingly erratic tariff regime. Since returning to office, he has slapped steep import taxes on goods from dozens of countries, including long-standing allies. Instead of reviving American industry, the tariffs have pushed production costs upward and left consumers footing the bill. Trump had promised Americans that prices would fall on day one of his presidency. Instead, a clear majority now report that their expenses have surged. Despite Trump's repeated insistence that there is virtually no inflation, a new Harris poll shows Americans continuing to feel financial strain and growing more pessimistic about the economic direction of the country. The data underscore their frustration. The typical American household now spends $208 more dollars every month just to purchase the same basket of goods and services as a year earlier, and more than $1,000 more per month compared with early 2021 when the nation was emerging from the pandemic. Now, many analysts believe that if the Trump administration continues doubling down on these policies, the financial pressure will only spread. Higher prices, fewer job opportunities, and a shrinking margin of stability for millions of households already stretched thin.
Iran Geo 2025 opening its doors to the public. The event that has rapidly become the country's main platform for showcasing advances in mapping, satellite imaging, GIS systems, and spatial data technologies. This year, for the first time, the Armed Forces Geographical Organization and the National Mapping Organization of Iran have joined hands to bring the entire geospatial ecosystem under one roof.
When governance is founded on information and knowledge, geospatial data becomes a powerful tool. Exhibitions like Iran Geo help us shape sound strategies and prevent future crises. Accurate spatial data reduces imbalances and supports smarter long-term planning. These technologies let us look ahead, not just react to problems, and that makes a lasting contribution to the country.
Knowledge-based firms filling several halls demonstrating AI-driven mapping engines, cloud-based GIS, drone surveying systems, and real-time spatial analytics.
This is one of the biggest cartography and geospatial technology events, not just in Iran, but in the region. The large number of foreign participants here shows its importance. Mapping from space, which is our area of specialization, is among the key joint projects. Many of the challenges humanity faces, from climate change and water scarcity to global warming and resource management, go beyond any single country. Our mapping strategies are now accurate to within 1 meter.
The Armed Forces Geographical Organization explaining how it delivered uninterrupted spatial support during the recent 12-day Israeli aggression.
Our goal is for government leaders to recognize and apply Iran's geospatial achievements in national planning. Many of today's challenges are rooted in geography, and spatial technologies help reduce inefficiencies and guide smarter decisions. These tools enable precise identification of issues, prevent overlap, and advance sustainable development.
Across the venue, visitors exploring how geospatial intelligence has become essential for everything from emergency response to infrastructure design. Over 100 foreign visitors, including BRICS and ECO military attachés, also visiting the venue.
I think it's very good that your country has an exhibition on the techniques and the new developments, and it's always good for a country to have a good geographical image of that country, especially at the moment climate problems, problems with the water, so it's always good to know what your country looks like.
Over 30 companies and 5 major national organizations are exhibiting their full portfolios this year.
Every journey starts with a map, and the Iran Geo International Exhibition serves as a platform that brings together technology, governance, and the science of cartography to chart the nation's path forward. Gisum Shahmari, Tehran.
The recent launch of a Muslim association aspiring to be registered as a political party has caused an uproar in Italy. The association, named MURO 27, the acronym for Muslims for Rome, aims to participate in the 2027 mayoral elections in the Italian capital, Rome. Following the announcement of the new association, several Italian media close to Italy's ruling right coalition and some anti-immigrant League party members have slammed the initiative as a threat
to Italy's liberal institutions, a project that, quote, aims to plant the crescent flag on Rome's Capitol Hill.
This initiative has been immediately exploited by some anti-immigrant, anti-Islam parties for political gain. Having said that, the initiators of this association should have involved the whole of the Muslim community.
I am of the idea that such initiatives are welcomed when they are in the public interest. Many Italians are very wary of traditional politics, but I am afraid they are not ready to support a Muslim candidate, as recently happened in New York.
The Muro 27 Association has been funded by a group of Muslims led by Francesco Thieri, an Italian engineer who converted to Islam about 20 years ago when he added to his name that of Abd al-Haq, one of the names of God in the Quran. Thieri already ran as a candidate in Rome's 2021 local elections. The Italian capital is home to about 120,000 Muslims, 40,000 of whom are Italian citizens. Islam is not formally recognized as a religion in Italy, despite 1.5 million Muslims live in the country. Furthermore, the organizations representing Muslims are also not legally recognized by the Italian state, albeit Muslims have the constitutional right to practice their religion.
To this day, the issue of the Muslims in Italy has been solely tackled with security policies, overlooking the political, social, and cultural dimensions of our religion. As for the new association, it's not clear yet, in my view, what the nature and the goals of this initiative are.
Strangely enough, Italy already has a Muslim mayor, but no controversy has been raised about his election. It is Moreno Marzetti, an Italian convert, who also is a member of the anti-Islam, anti-immigrant League party. He was elected as mayor of Italy's northern town of Malo in 2020. Max Civili, Press TV, Rome.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hazrat Fatima alayha salam is the role model for women throughout history and for all. In the history of Islam, for every group or stratum of society, there is a suitable role model whose guiding light for salvation and on the path to perfection. The role model for women, as declared by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and His Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, is Hazrat Fatima Zahra alayha salam. As rightly stated by the noble Prophet, Fatima is the best of all women of the world, Sayyidat Nisa'i al-Alameen, and a role model for all Muslim women. Referring to this, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, The history of Islam is witness to the immense respect that the Prophet ﷺ had for Hazrat Zahra alayha salam, which also powerfully reflects on the importance of women in society. If they are not superior to men, they are definitely not any inferior. At a time when people buried their daughters alive, with the birth of Hazrat Fatima Zahra alayha salam, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala revealed the chapters of Kawthar, Qadr, and Dharr to praise her auspicious birth. By kissing Hazrat Fatima alayha salam's hand and by praising her virtues, the Prophet of Islam sallallahu alayhi wa sallam firmly established the value of women in the Islamic society. This Fatima alayha salam is the role model of all women of the world. Her greatness is not limited to any particular time, period, or location. As stated by the Prophet of Islam, Fatima alayhi salam is the best woman ever from the beginning of time up to its end. Hazrat Fatima alayha salam is the role model for women throughout history and for all generations, past, present, and future. The divine aspect of human beings is perfectly manifested in her. If we study the history of mankind, we find that certain people have been looked upon as exemplars for certain qualities that they have perfected. But Hazrat Fatima Zahra alayha salam is a role model for everyone. In all aspects, be it ethics, spirituality, or Gnosticism. The level of her knowledge was so high that even the angels descended upon her. From the spiritual aspect too, she was very detached from worldly distractions and was praised by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and His Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. She prayed a lot and used to tremble and shed tears of awe and love during her worship.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone, to this episode of Spotlight. For decades, Europe was told it had a reliable partner across the Atlantic, a defender of a rules-based order. But now that promise lies broken and exposed as a lie. The so-called peace plan unveiled by Donald Trump is more than just a proposal to end the war in Ukraine. It is a stunning act of unilateral force drafted in secret and presented to Europe as a finished deal they had no choice but to accept. Washington, in its arrogance, kept both Kiev and its European allies entirely in the dark on matters that directly threaten their very security. This is not diplomacy. It is a dictated peace. It is a plan that reads like a list of concessions to the Kremlin, demanding Ukraine surrender its sovereignty, its territory, and its future. And it comes with a threat. Sign or face the consequences. Tonight we ask, is this the end of the Atlantic Alliance? Has the United States under Trump become not a partner but a danger to European security? And how will Europe and a besieged Ukraine respond to this brutal new reality? But first, let's get more details in this report.
Ukraine's European allies are holding talks on the sideline of the G20 summit over Trump's proposed peace plan to end the Ukraine war. In a joint statement, they described the proposal as unilateral, saying that it requires additional work. They expressed concern over the proposed limitations on Ukraine's armed forces, saying it leaves the country vulnerable to future attacks.
The war can only end with Ukraine's unconditional consent. Wars cannot be ended by major powers over the heads of the countries involved. Rather, this is a war that can only end with Ukraine's consent and with our consent, the consent of the European Union, because it is a war on the European continent.
Kiev has also rejected key elements of the plan. The Ukrainian president's office said the country will never be an obstacle to peace, but emphasized that its representatives would continue to defend the legitimate interests of the Ukrainian people. President Volodymyr Zelensky has warned that Ukraine is facing one of the most difficult moments in its history.
Now is one of the most difficult moments in our history. Now the pressure on Ukraine is one of the most difficult. Now Ukraine may find itself facing a very difficult choice. Either the loss of dignity or the risk of losing a key partner. We did not betray Ukraine then, we will not do it now. And I know for sure that in this truly one of the most difficult moments in our history, I am not alone.
Neighboring Poland also expressed firm opposition, insisting that any peace agreement must be accepted by Kiev and that Ukrainians themselves must have a central role in negotiations. The White House has denied that Ukraine was sidelined, but skepticism in Europe remains high. Trump, meanwhile, has escalated pressure on Kiev, warning that Ukraine would lose additional territory in a short amount of time if it refused the plan, and declaring that Zelensky is going to have to approve it.
Well, he'll have to like it, and if he doesn't like it, then, you know, they should just keep fighting, I guess, you know.
The U.S. president said he had given Ukraine until Thursday to agree to the plan. According to widely leaked drafts, the U.S. plan includes several concessions Ukraine has previously ruled out. These include recognizing Crimea, Luhansk, and Donetsk as de facto Russian, obliging Ukraine to constitutionally renounce NATO membership, and reducing Ukraine's armed forces to 600,000 troops. Additional provisions would bar NATO troop deployments in Ukraine. The text also outlines steps for Russia's reintegration into the global economy and its return to the G8. For many European governments, the episode has exposed a far deeper worry. A peace plan drafted behind closed doors, unveiled as a near-final document, and built around sweeping concessions to Moscow, has intensified the sense that Washington under Trump is no longer behaving like a dependable ally. European officials say the administration bypassed NATO entirely, kept key European capitals in the dark about provisions that directly affect their own security, and excluded Ukraine, the country at the center of the war, from any meaningful role in shaping its terms. For Europe, the episode is a blunt reminder that under Trump, the United States is prepared to act unilaterally on matters central to Europe's security, even if its closest allies are left entirely out of the room.
Well, to analyze these new developments, we are joined by Mr. John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst, joining us from Fredericton, Canada. And Mr. John Stuttling, author and commentator, joining us from Inderøy, Norway. Well, gentlemen, I'd like to thank both of you very much for joining us during this episode of Spotlight, of course. Mr. Bosnich, let's go ahead and start off with you, please. Let's start off with this U.S. unilateralism. Now, the Trump administration completely bypassed the NATO and the key European capitals in drafting this plan. Does this prove or at least signal that the transatlantic alliance is indeed finished?
Well, the transatlantic alliance, as we euphemistically call it, was never an alliance. It was an empire ruled from Washington with some advisors from London. And the rest of the countries across the mainland of Europe, were merely cannon fodder for an anticipated war against the Soviet Union. So this whole charade of a partnership, of an alliance, of America's partners not being satisfied that they weren't consulted, that is, to use the initials, that is complete BS. There is nothing that the European so-called partners have ever been able to say to Washington. Washington has always been their controllers, and what's happening today with respect to Ukraine is an example of how Washington crushes opposing opinions among its federated military colonies. That's the straight story about what's happening.
Well, with that, let's go ahead and cross over to Mr. Stuttling. Mr. Stuttling, as we just now heard from Mr. Bosnich, I mean, basically the truth of what the U.S. is, what many people around the world know what the U.S. is, other than, of course, mainstream media, what they imply on what the U.S. is. This plan was presented, as we had mentioned, as a final document and, of course, not even as a starting point for negotiations. When it comes to the situation about Trump saying take it or leave it, what does this reveal about the U.S. and how it's using its power under Trump, or has this actually always been the situation with the U.S., or is it basically that Trump is just more clear about it?
Well, let's remember, firstly, that the U.S., began interfering in Russian elections all the way back in 1996. They made a Hollywood movie about it called Spinning Boris. Then there was 2014, the Maidan coup, completely orchestrated by the U.S., State Department, CIA. The U.S. has been meddling in all of this from the beginning. They kept moving NATO eastward. So this idea that somehow giving Donbass to Russia is an example of caving in to the dictator Putin, this is nonsense. Does everybody forget for 7 years Donbass was bombed? It's predominantly ethnically Russian, Russian-speaking, and they were bombed by Kiev, terrorized by Kiev. People just seem to have this complete amnesia about this stuff. It's stunning. But the other thing is, we keep hearing in all of this, well, European security is threatened. Is somebody thinking that Russia is going to invade Norway or Spain or something anytime soon? Because they're not. They have no interest in trying to occupy a European country. I mean, this is farcical. It's pure fantasy. So yes, the U.S. acts unilaterally, but they always have. They just gave it a cosmetic treatment that made it appear democratic many times. But of course NATO is run by the U.S. All policy decisions coming out of NATO have always been carried out by the U.S., carried out in Washington. So what we're seeing also, though, with European leadership, people like Jens Stoltenberg and Merz in Germany and Macron and the Finns and the Estonians, is this rabid Russophobia. And I always hearken back to the dismantling of Yugoslavia, because that was a lesson that people seem to not have learned, how that was carried out. That was the last nominally socialist state in Europe, and the U.S. had to see it crushed. The European leadership went along with that enthusiastically because there was money to be made. And so now we're seeing all of this saber-rattling from European leadership and from Brussels, van der Leyen, and Miss Callas. You know, and they have no leverage. They rattle sabers that are made of paper mache. So it's the whole thing just strikes me as comical at this point.
Well, Mr. Stepling, I mean, as you're talking, I can definitely see Mr. Bosnich nodding and grinning in agreement, I believe. But Mr. Bosnich, I mean, you guys both mentioned the situation with the U.S., how history has basically shown. I do want to ask you, Mr. Bosnich, in relation to President Zelensky himself. Now, he spoke about this choice between losing dignity or losing a partner. Where does he fit in with all of this? I mean, the way that things have been playing specifically on media.
Well, first of all, this is whatever he says is what's being written for him by his CIA scriptwriters. The CIA organized through corrupt oligarchs in post-communist Ukraine. They organized the transfer of money to Ukraine to create Zelensky. So I appreciate the remarks of my fellow commentator today about people don't seem to learn lessons, or they don't at least remember lessons from the past, but you can't remember what you never learned. And the lying mainstream media, plus the totally dysfunctional educational system in the West, has hidden the fact that from the end of World War II, the United States and England especially have been active in Ukraine. In the 1940s and 50s, they recruited former Waffen-SS officers to run guerrilla operations in Ukraine. They then recruited many exiled Ukrainians and brought them into the State Department and planned these actions decades ago. My father was an acquaintance of Zbig Brzezinski, who went to university with him in Canada. He visited Zbig in 1978 in the White House when they discussed the upcoming plan for the disruption of Ukraine. And this was even before the Soviet Union collapsed. So there is nothing new under the sun, and certainly not in Ukraine. As for Zelensky is literally nothing other than a paid actor who was selected by his boss, the oligarch Kolomoisky, who has run off to Israel to hide, who worked for the CIA. And this is the final act of a very sorry and bloodthirsty tale written in Washington in the late 1940s as they looked at what resources they might have beyond the Iron Curtain, and they looked to former Nazis and they recruited them. And that's the explanation for why we've seen so many Ukrainian soldiers with SS and swastika tattoos burned into their bodies by their own choice. This reality is what is coming to the fore. And there's nobody in the EU who doesn't realize this. And all of their crocodile tears that they're crying now about, Russia did this and America is telling us what to do, all of that is another example of acting by players who knew for years that this was coming up and that if they failed, they would have to disavow it. Nothing more. A PSYOP operated from Washington and running as a boat of death on the blood of Slavs, both Ukrainians and Russians, because it's a no-lose situation for Washington. If they can make the Ukrainian and Russian brothers hate each other for the next 20 or 30 years, they will have achieved one of their primary goals.
Well, Mr. Sapling, I mean, the plan, as we were mentioning, reportedly forces Ukraine to give up any hope of joining the NATO. Now, what would you tell viewers and people around the world that are saying, isn't this basically handing Putin his biggest victory on a silver platter, coincidentally being delivered by an American partner? Where is Putin in all of this, and Russia, of course?
Well, I mean, Russia won the war. This tends to be what happens when you win a war. But again, remember that this was a corrupt regime in Kiev before Zelensky that was bombing the Donbass, which is predominantly Russian. They talk about the illegal annexation of Crimea. There was, in fact, a referendum. But these points have long historic tales behind them. You can't really understand it unless, as John pointed out, you go back to World War II and the end of World War II. But beyond that, what Ukraine right now is primarily objecting to in this peace plan is not giving up territory, is not losing any hope of joining NATO. They were terrified about this audit that was going to happen because they obviously are corrupt and stole dozens of billions of dollars that they have no way of explaining the disappearance. And it went into the pockets of oligarchs and Zelensky's pals and into Zelensky's pocket. And the thing is, everybody knows this. I mean, we're seeing, Zelensky's not the only actor here. I mean, we see these performances from European leaders as if the Russian hordes are assembling at the gates to the European civilization, and they're about to break through and march down the Champs-Élysées or something. I mean, Russia has enough on its plate. It's going to be quite happy to just wrap this up and hopefully get some relief from sanctions and so forth. But they have no imperialist ambition whatsoever. I mean, this is just ludicrous. So John's right. This was Washington wanting to put a ribbon on it, get done with it. Russia won the war. It's over. It's been over for 8-10 months. There was, it was a complete waste of life for the last 10 months. They have been shanghaiing men off the street in Ukraine to use as cannon fodder, throwing them into this meat grinder. It's the typical story of war. The rich get richer. Defense contractors made a lot of money, so it was prolonged as long as it was possible, and now it's not possible. And as I say, Ukraine's biggest fear right now, the Zelensky administration's fear, is that they don't want an audit. The rest of it, they don't care about. This was, Crimea and Donbass was lost a long time ago. So this is, of course, written and scripted by Washington, because most everything in the world is these days. And this is no exception. I mean, I predict Zelensky will end up with a late night talk show in Miami. And that's probably where, that was his past, and that's going to be his future.
And Mr. Bosnich, what do you have in regards to what Mr. Sapling said? Do you believe that the war in Russia-Ukraine is finally over and this is the ending?
Well, I'm actually more optimistic than he is. I think the war will continue. And the reason why I say that's optimistic is because I think that although Russia is prepared to have a peace agreement at this time, Zelensky is not. Because the people who pay Zelensky are telling him, listen, puppet, you're going to do what we say, or you are not going to be alive in a very short period of time. And so for Zelensky, it's a matter of life and death. And if he were ever to show up, as my fellow commentator says, in a talk show in Florida, it would be in the same cell as the Americans stuck their former collaborator Noriega, or wherever they stick any one of their tin pot puppet dictators once he's no longer useful to them. And the sad fact of this matter is that the Ukrainian people were deceived. Their lying mainstream media in Ukraine worked for a Hollywood script to create the servant of the people, who was no such thing. Zelensky was a servant of the CIA. That's the movie that needs to be made from his jail cell in Florida when he finally gets there, if he lives long enough to get there. This is a picture of the reality of the totally corrupt Anglo-American empire in play all the time for not just the past, you know, 3 years of this war, but for the entire period, for the 11 years since the United States staged the fake coup d'etat in Kiev that brought to power the entire gang behind Zelensky. And I'm glad that the other commentator today mentioned Yugoslavia, because I don't know if I've mentioned it before, but I was an advisor to former President Milosevic when he was kidnapped and taken to The Hague. My family comes from Yugoslavia, and I was living until recently and will be returning to Serbia, the center of the former Yugoslavia. And what has happened in Ukraine is transparent to me and those of us who lived through the Yugoslav operation, because it's identical. They set up a fake group of puppets. Those puppets were corrupt and stole money. They were removed and replaced by other puppets, and you have the disaster zone that is known as Serbia today, with people marching for a year against a corrupt, totally criminal government. This is what always happens when you get crooks like the CIA, and you dress them up in a suit and tie and pretend that they are statesmen. These are not statesmen. They are having no more success than putting lipstick on a pig.
Exactly, as you did mention, dressing up in suit and a tie, something we've seen in Syria and others recently, specifically. Mr. Steplin, we do have a few more minutes. I'd like to direct this question towards you. Under the Trump administration, under the U.S. specifically, last few years, I mean, the global system has been replaced. Has it been replaced in a system we now live in, which is basically a jungle where only threats and force matter?
Well, let me try to answer that in a slightly circuitous way, but apropos of what John said, I was part of the committee to defend Milosevic, actually, and was in Serbia a couple of times during that period, and the U.S., as is always the case, was aligned with the fascists, the Croat fascists that go back to World War II. The people that constructed the Jasenovac concentration camp and so forth. The United States is never on the side of democracy. They weren't in Latin America or in Africa. They fought against African independence. They are always on the side of dictators because dictators are easier to control. Zelensky fits this to a T. But the idea that we're now in a jungle, we have always been in a jungle. I mean, this is Western imperialism, and the West is prone to coercive measures whenever they can. I mean, we look at the dying empire today, though, because the U.S. keeps threatening, for example, Venezuela, but they can't really invade Venezuela because their power has waned considerably. And the only thing that has changed with Trump is that he sort of has done away with the middleman, and he just cuts to the chase. But all these European leaders are flailing about, and they simply have no leverage. They have nothing to back up this. Macron was talking about the French are ready to go to Ukraine and fight. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that's going to happen. I mean, I don't mean to laugh at this, but I don't know another response that makes sense. This is U.S. imperialism. It's as it has existed for 70 years, and it's no different. The end is, whether John is right or I am right about exactly how long Zelensky can stay alive and occupy his presidential suites, I don't know. He is beholden to the Azov battalion people, the far right fascists in Ukraine. They may want to take him out at a certain point. They clearly, those people are going to feel betrayed, certainly. But this was inevitable a year ago. This was inevitable. It was just going to be a matter of how and when and exactly what the terms of the so-called peace were going to look like. And they pretty much have ended up as most of us, I think, saw they were going to.
Well, on that point, I'd like to thank both of my guests, of course, for this very interesting discussion on this episode of Spotlight. From Fredericton, Canada, journalist, activist, and political analyst, Mr. John Bosnich. And, of course, as always, Mr. John Stepling, author and commentator. They're joining us from Indira, Norway. A pleasure to have you both. Until next time, goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.